Buenos días, el Ministerio de Educación Nacional les da nuevamente la cordial bienvenida al seminario taller Estrategias para el Uso de Aprendizaje y Redes de Alta Velocidad, el cual se ha planteado en el marco del proyecto de uso de nuevas tecnologías y metodologías en la educación superior para congregar experiencias exitosas en materia de aprovechamiento y utilización de redes de alta velocidad y objetos de aprendizaje a nivel nacional e internacional. Hoy es el último día del taller Estrategias para el Uso de Objetos de Aprendizaje y Redes de Alta Velocidad, y en nuestra agenda de la mañana hemos hecho un cambio en el orden. Las dos conferencias que tendremos en esta primera jornada son Bancos Nacionales de Objetos de Aprendizaje y Derechos de Autor con expertos de Canadá y Colombia. Iniciamos entonces nuestra jornada con el doctor Stephen Downs, quien nos presentará Bancos Nacionales de Objetos de Aprendizaje. El doctor Downs es investigador senior en el Consejo Nacional de Investigación de Canadá. También participa en el grupo de investigación en e-learning del Instituto de Tecnologías de Información de Moncton de New Brunswick y se ha convertido en voz líder en el área de objetos de aprendizaje y metadatos en Canadá. Antes de dar paso al Dr. Downs, le recuerdo tener listas sus inquietudes y preguntas para realizarlas una vez finalizada la conferencia. Damos la bienvenida al Dr. Downs.
Gracias. Buenos días. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again, and it's especially a pleasure to be back for a second day after the first day. After I did my talk yesterday, they sent me to the salt mines, and I was a bit worried, but no, I'm just kidding. But it really is a pleasure to be back. Today's topic is National Learning Object Repositories, and I'll be following from many of the themes from yesterday's talk. Yesterday's talk, for those of you who weren't here, was about learning objects and learning object metadata and some of the issues involved in learning objects. Today, I'm going to look at the software systems that are used to store and to distribute learning objects. In other words, to make them available to people. And I just want to preface this a bit before I actually start talking about them. Yesterday's talk was was nice, it was linear, it was smooth and all of that. The world of learning objects is repositories is a bit more messy. And so you'll see in this presentation we don't have the nice smooth progression. We're going to go back and forth and cut across a few themes. And that's necessitated by the nature of the subject. Learning object repositories, that subject is actually a very complex subject, and it's going to bring in some discussions from a number of fields. And for those of you who were here for the question and answer after my talk yesterday, you'll recognize some of the themes that I talked about yesterday coming up in today's paper, or today's talk. It's not really a paper. So what is a repository? I think of a repository just as a place somewhere on the internet where you put stuff. It's like the barn of the internet. That's perhaps a bad example, but this definition is typical. There isn't really the whole definitional problem for repositories, but it's a set of services, a set of programs and services for the management and dissemination or distribution of digital materials that are created typically by an institution, and this will be one of the issues that we look at, the whole idea of institutional versus non-institutional repositories. And the idea here is that the repository, at least according to Cliff Lynch, is more than just some software. It's actually a concept. It's a way of thinking of distributing materials. But in actual practice, a learning object repository will always be some software application that is running on your institutional web server that provides storage and access to these digital materials, and in our case, typically digital learning materials. This creates several roles for a learning object repository. First of all, and most importantly, to create access to, and for many of us who are working in the field of learning object repositories, this means open access to and reuse of scholarly materials. And typically, what we would mean by that are learning objects. So it's a place to put our learning objects and give access to them. Typically, a learning object repository or a digital repository will serve a particular community. It might serve an institution such as a college or a university, or it might be a repository for a specific discipline such as genetics or chemistry or some other subject I don't know about. And the idea of these repositories is that they should be, and I'm sort of being careful how I phrase that, they should be interoperable with other institutional services. We think of a repository as one of a set of applications. So, for example, if you have an authoring tool, a place where you create your learning resources, that should connect to the digital repository. Or if you have a learning management system, which is displaying materials, that also should connect to your repository. I was just like, he almost fell. There's all kinds of repositories out there, and I'm going to link to a list here of some prominent national repositories. And we'll see. This will be Internet Explorer again. And no second of, oh, this saying, oh, acceptor. When it says acceptor. And, okay, so we'll wait for that. This has been a trend recently where in addition to simply institutions or interest groups having learning object repositories, entire countries have had learning object repositories, and I was hoping for that link here, and I see somebody's plugging it in. Oh, quite literally. That's pretty funny. That's rule number one with technology. If something doesn't work, check and make sure. Is it plugged in? You think this doesn't come up? We'll have to give that a second for it to register on the network. My background and experience in learning object repositories, in fact, comes from just such a national network, EduSource in Canada. And this list here, when it comes up, we'll provide links to some of the other national repositories. such as Merlot in the United States, Edna in Australia, Terrio, the Campus Alberta, here we go, Network of Learning Object Repositories. Here's the Terrio link, Canada SchoolNet, which is a repository of learning resources for the kindergarten to grade 12 sector. Connections, which interestingly just recently has resulted in the revival of the Rice University Press, and Connections is being used as a repository for Rice University in the United States. CLOE, the Cooperative Learning Object Exchange, is a very active learning object repository, and what's interesting about CLOE is that it's also based on a community of practice model. So they have these CLOE camps, and instructors come to the CLOE camps and they learn how to use CLOE and how to make learning objects and all of that. And that's based essentially at the University of Waterloo, and Tom Carey is one of the major people behind that. There's Education Network Australia, and I should mention in that context as well, although the link will be there, the Learning Federation also in Australia. And as you can see, the GEM project is an American learning object repository. That's been around for a long time. Some of the learning object repositories, especially at the national level, sometimes they come and they go, and it's kind of an interesting thing. So not all of these exist anymore, so I'm skipping some of them. Merlot is a very interesting learning object repository. It's based mostly in the United States. It also has members in Canada. And the way Merlot works, it's a consortium of universities, and each university pays, I forget the exact amount, I believe it was about $10,000. That would be, let's see, multiply 20 million pesos, roughly, in order to join this consortium. And the way they do their work is, professors at the different universities create their learning objects and submit them to Merlot, and then Merlot has subject-based peer review committees. And so in Merlot, these peer review committees will go from object to object and do a peer review of them. It was an interesting experiment, although in my own opinion, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, I don't think it was an entirely successful experiment. And so on. And again, you can access this website from my slides, and my slides will be on my website later today. There are many different systems that can be used, different software applications that can be used in order to create or set up an institutional repository. And I'm just looking for the list of them here. I believe it's in this. Oh, this is... Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I thought this article had the list of different software applications, but it doesn't. It has the different list of contents of learning object repositories. And that's the next slide. And again, we think of these digital repositories as containing things like learning objects, but as it happens, and in actual practice, we need to expand our idea of what these repositories can contain. One of the major uses for digital repositories is for the storage and provision of access to academic papers. And there's an entire initiative, the Open Archives Initiative, that does this. Learning materials, of course, research data, raw research data, such as empirical results, measurements, study results, things like that. Geospatial data, geographic information or map-type information is a very good source. And especially with a resource like Google Maps. I don't know, how many of you are familiar with Google Maps? Good, yeah, more than half of you. And then, of course, the desktop application, Google Earth. And you can layer in geographic data and overlay it onto Google Maps. So if you have geographic data and you code it properly, you use a Google defined XML format, and you make this available, people access this data, and it'll layer the data on top of your map. I've been cycling around recently, and so I've been putting my cycling routes on top of the Google Map. It's a very simple example of that. And, you know, and this is just a short list. You can go way beyond just these kind of traditional academic materials. Audio recordings, games, videos, multimedia animations, anything, any sort of digital resource can go into one of these digital repositories. This is a simple model, and I emphasize simple. We're going to come back to that concept in a bit. What the overall structure of a digital repository would look like. This is from my own architecture. And you can see, I'm not sure where it'll be on your screen. Hang on. Okay. Way over there at the far side, the material is brought in or uploaded into the repository. And typically, not always, but typically, some sort of identification process will be applied. So you upload, say, a video to your repository, and the repository will give your video a name or a number, some unique identifier. The resources then are stored, and metadata, remember we talked about metadata yesterday, is also stored in the repository. This metadata is made accessible to the world through a process of harvesting. Recall yesterday I talked about these learning object metadata harvesters, or the RSS harvesters, aggregators. That's the process that's happening here. And then there are some other functions that are more optional functions. You can divide your repository into different categories of learning resources, or sets, as they're called. And some, although certainly not all, digital repositories can offer a search facility. And I'm going to come back to that because there are some major issues surrounding the provision of search in these repositories. In the green are some examples of typical learning or typical digital repositories, OAI, DSpace, CoreDraw. I'll talk about all of these in more detail later on in the talk. And then coming out from the repository are the resources themselves. They might be XML, they might be in HTML, they might be Flash, digital, whatever. And then on the other side, coming out of the repository, is the metadata. It might be in RSS or in Dublin Core or in Learning Object metadata. So that's the basic picture. Now what happens is you give this basic picture to professors and researchers and it gets very complicated in a hurry. Sorry, again I need to pause for breath. Just like yesterday. Because I forget. Right? I forget where I am, and I talk at sea level speed, and then I realize, wait a second here, I'm not getting any air, and then the blackness comes. And I'm kidding. Like I said, complex, in a hurry. This is a presentation by Andy Powell, where he looks in quite a bit more detail about the sorts of things that a digital repository would provide, sorts of services. Look at the, it's going to be at the far side again, look at enter, right? For simply for a person to type the URL in their browser or whatever and get into the repository, there are processes that may have to be undertaken, such as authentication if you want to restrict access, or user preferences if you want certain types of display. And then if you're new to the repository, in some cases the repository may provide some survey services. For example, if you want to find out what services the repository offers, you need to find out, you need to consult a service registry, which will be a list of the services. And different repositories use different terminology or different vocabularies or different taxonomies, and you need to be able to access that. And then there's the whole discovery thing, and I'm going to talk more, quite a bit more about that later on. And the identification thing, identifier or resolver, and then the actual request, can I get something from you finally? And then the delivery of the material. And you can see all of these things can be part of a piece of learning or piece of repository software. Part of my approach to this is mostly these things are not necessary. You remember yesterday I was talking, right, about the traditional picture of learning objects, and then the new picture, and the traditional picture was something that was very detailed and very involved and very complex, but the way that seems to actually work is a very simple, easy to use, intuitive approach to learning resources, something that's flexible. And the same sort of logic will apply to the discussion and the definition of learning object repositories. This is a good picture. Again, it's overly complicated. This is also from Andy Powell. But it gives you an idea of how these digital repositories operate together in a network. Those tube-shaped things at the top are separate repositories, separate instances. So it might be a content provider, it might be an institution, it might be external. And then there are different layers of the repository that organize and filter the content coming out. Some of these repositories may have a million resources in them. And if you just simply access the repository and type, you know, list, you might be there for, well, the rest of your life watching these resources come out. So you need things that will organize and filter and present these lists of resources in a way that you can handle. And then, of course, once these resources are listed, then they're actually presented to the rest of the world, and that's the bottom layer that we see at the side. And then in this diagram we have the common services like authentication and registration, or the metadata schemas, which schema are you going to use, or for example the identification system, the mechanism you use to identify the learning resources. See, I told you, this is more complex. It's a mess, isn't it? And we want to draw that out. We want to draw the essence of that out, because who can afford to build that? I mean, I can't. And even if I could afford to build it, you know, you build a system like this with all of these different pieces, and it's all one big, huge piece of software, and you dramatically increase the risk that it won't work, that it'll fail. So I'm going to come back to something a little simpler. The Open Archives Initiative is a project that started as a result of the desire of many scholars to make their academic papers available for free for people to read around the world. And in order to do this, they had to create their own software in order to store these papers, to index these papers, and present them. And so what they did is they came up with a very simple protocol based on harvesting. The Open Archives Initiative protocol operates or looks very much the same as RSS. Do you remember the RSS picture that I showed yesterday with the contents producer and the metadata gets harvested, and then the user accesses the metadata and then retrieves the metadata? So it looked like a big triangle. Open Archives Initiative works in almost exactly the same way. What's happened since the Open Archive Initiative has been founded and established these basic protocols is some well-used and well-known software applications to provide OAI archives, OAI repositories, have been made available. DSpace is a fairly complex application that came out of MIT. It has been used here in Colombia. I don't believe it's being used anymore. But DSpace is very widely used in the United States. ePrint is another application that does a similar sort of thing. It's software that would typically run a discipline-based open archives repository. And Stephen Harnett, who's one of the major people behind OAI and open access, recommends this. He just wrote, it was just about 2 days ago, he said, let me be perfectly clear. This is the one that I recommend. And then Fedora is an open source digital repository architecture as well that allows packaging of content. I haven't worked with Fedora, so I can't say a whole lot about it, but it's in the list. And now we go back to complex, because you take that basic harvesting idea and you apply it to learning resources. I'm moving around and driving the sound people nuts. Just having fun. Because what they've developed in Britain, and this is GISC, and Britain has developed this, is something called the E-Framework. And again, the idea of the E-Framework is to define the various processes and services that would be required by, say, a national repository network in order to make access to these digital resources possible and useful to applications. And so they've divided, and there's hundreds of these things, and you can probably not read them because they're so small, and this was the biggest I could make this diagram. But there's the three major divisions of these services. There's the what they call the user agents, but these would be the tools that a student or a professor actually works with. For example, a portal or an authoring application or a learning management system. And then there are, in the green in the middle, are services that would be specific to learning institutions, learning domain services, sequencing. Remember I talked about sequencing yesterday. Learning flow, which is just another way of saying sequencing. Grading, marking, competency. E-portfolios that I mentioned yesterday. So those sorts of services. And then in the bottom are these common services. Digital rights management. Remember we talked about that yesterday. Chat services, whiteboard, authentication and registration, logging in, search, content management. And you know, you almost think that they sat down and they wrote out everything that you could possibly want and then said, this is our framework. And I sort of look at this, and you know, I think that in many cases, a lot of these things aren't needed. But also, too, I think in many cases, these services are not going to be unique to the learning domain and do not need to be part of a learning framework. Take, for example, chat. Why would educational institutions need to define their own standard for chat? We have chat all over the place on the internet. We have instant messaging like ICQ or AOL instant messaging or the Microsoft product, which I won't name, or even Skype. I can't resist a dig at Microsoft. And so the sort of thing that we should be thinking is not, you know, how can learning institutions create a chat engine, but you know, to know and understand that this chat system that people already use outside the educational institution is something they could use inside the institution as well, and we think about that. And there are more of these things as well. Digital rights management, for example. I don't think anybody could believe that there will be a university or education-specific digital rights management scheme. That would make no sense. But yet, they have an education-specific authentication and registration scheme called Shibboleth. And I sort of wonder, why would you do that? Why would you have a login system only for educational institutions and not useful anywhere else on the internet? More complexity. That was the British approach. Now we see the American approach. I talked about, yesterday I talked about advanced distributed learning and their metadata format and SCORM. Well, this is their more recent work in digital repositories, CORDRA. Now I have to remember what that stands for. Common Object Repository. Anyhow, I'm sorry, I've forgotten it off the top of my head. But again, you can get, there's the links here by Dan Rehack. I mentioned Dan Rehack yesterday. But I actually recommend Wilbert Cran. He's from CITUS. And John Mason, he's from Edna in Australia. And their overview, or their summary of CORDRA. And what we see is that CORDRA is doing pretty much the same kind of thing. We're going to have the local or institution-based repositories. We're also going to have the system repositories. That might be a national repository or something like that. And these applications, I assume that's up there, these applications, and here we see search, harvest, register, you know, these common services, just like before. What distinguishes CORDRA, I remember CORDRA comes from Advanced Distributed Learning, and remember that they're working with the U.S. military, and so there's going to be that sort of influence. And so we got, on the other side, where is it, up here, right, I forget left from right, so don't ever give me instructions while I'm driving, you'll end up in a canal. The identifier system. What CORDRA does is, remember I talked about each, when you put a resource into a repository, we'll give each one of these a name, some sort of identification. Well, there's an identification system called the handle system. And that's a use of digital object identifiers. And so what you do is you put the resource in the system, and then you associate it with this handle. And there's a very precise syntax for how to define a handle. And then this handle, this unique identifier for the object, goes into a registry. Then when you go to access the object, you don't remember, like on the World Wide Web, when you go to access an object, you type in the address, right? The actual location of where the object is. In the handle system, you type in the handle. And what happens is your browser or your application will contact the registry. And the registry will look at the handle, and then it will send back to you the URL. And then your system goes and gets the object. So it's a two-request kind of process, right? First get the address, and then get the object. The reason why they do this, and it kind of makes sense, right? If you have a repository system that's intended to be used by a very large audience all over the world, then your objects, you want to have your objects in different locations. If you have people in, say, Saudi Arabia, it's a lot faster to get an object from Medina than it is to get an object from Seattle. And so the way the system works is you access the identifier, the handle system looks at where you're asking from and says, oh, he's in Saudi Arabia, and it sends the Saudi Arabia address back rather than the Seattle address. So a system like this separates the location from the identification of the object, allowing the identification to point to different instances of the object as appropriate. But this is CORDRA, and I had a good argument with Dan Rehack about this, because this is used not just for convenience, although they'll sell it that way. This is also used to control access. And in my view, a system like this breaks the internet. Because if you think about it, there you are, you're out there, you're trying to access an object, and so you type in the handle of the object, and the system might send you back the address or it might not. Typically what the system will do is it'll look and say, who are you? And say, oh, you can't have that object. So it'll say, where are you from? Well, you're from Cuba. Sorry, no object for you. You know? And also, It'll look at who you are and where you're from, and it might deliver different versions of the same object. So, if we're in Canada and we access an object, we'll get one version of maple leaf, second largest country in the world, all of that. But if you're in the United States, you'll get a different version of the object. It's kind of like CNN in the U.S. and CNN Europe, and the same channel, two completely different things. So, there's this separation. It puts this barrier in between the user and access to resource and creates this very powerful mechanism for control in the hands of these handle registries. Now, they say anybody can set up a handle registry, but of course you have to pay money to the handle people in order to set up one of these registries. And in practice, we know how this works. In practice, only governments and large companies will be able to set up registries because, if you have 1,000 registries, typically you use the registry everyone else uses, which will be the government one or the Microsoft one or whatever. So, I had a big argument with them about this, because something like the handle system, in my view, works fundamentally against open access. And further, I argue that something like the sorts of problems that are intended to be handled by the handle system, how's that for a sentence? Sorry about that, translators. Can be addressed through software on your web browser. I could write, I have a URL that points to my website. Somebody comes in and they access an application on my website, and I can send them one object or another object or whatever. So I can solve all of these problems locally. I don't need to make it a part of the structure of the internet. And this is a general principle for networks, and I know a lot of you are involved in these networks. Make the network stupid and make the intelligence exist around the edges. Trying to put more function into the network itself makes the network less effective. And so my interest, my dedication is toward open repository networks. And here I link, and you notice it's an ePrint site, I link to a registry of open access repositories. There's a lot of people working in the area of open access repositories. And again, as of July 23rd, 497 institutional repositories and various others. Peter Suber is a very well-known and important figure in the field of open access and open archives. I certainly recommend him, and Stephen Harnett are probably the two major people behind these initiatives. But of course, it's a cast of thousands. So, that's kind of the state of the art. That's where we are. And now, of course, the question is, where are we going to go in the future? Where do we continue our develop of digital repositories? Because we have nothing like, a common system yet. It really is a mishmash. And so Andy Powell and Rachel Heary presented this roadmap. And there's the three major components. The first is to try to define what an object is. And, of course, educators look at that and say, no, don't define. And they're thinking of Dublin Core. Those of you who are not familiar with Dublin Core, what that is an XML specification. I guess it's a standard now. Remember I showed you RSS yesterday. Dublin Core is very similar to RSS, but it's intended more for published resources. So Dublin Core will include a field for publisher, for example, and a couple of other of these basic fields. But again, it's a very simple protocol, and there's work underway right now to integrate Dublin Core and RSS, and in fact, that has been done, and to integrate Dublin Core and learning object metadata. So that work is sort of proceeding along. With me, personally, I'm happy with RSS. Who needs more? Then they want to talk about a complex object model. We talked, remember, yesterday about content packaging. That's what this sort of thing involves. And me, it's kind of weird. I feel like a traditionalist in so many ways. I think we have a perfectly good complex object model. And to me, that model is the web page. Because we have the basic structure of a web page in HTML, and then we have all the smaller bits that can be accessed inside the web page, such as the image, or a JavaScript RSS feed, or an object, such as an embedded video. And to me, that seems to me to be a perfectly good complex object model. So, and then finally, the third part are the service models that I've been talking about. And, you know, there's no common understanding or agreement among educational institutions about how to upload content to a repository, which is sort of hard to believe. But again, I sort of take the approach here that we don't need education-specific service models. What we want to do is identify and work with service models for the wider internet. And this reflects a general philosophy that I have. You know, we've traditionally always thought of education as something that happens here, and the rest of life as something that happens here. Education is separate from life. You know, we build special buildings for education. We have special protocols and all of that. And I think more and more what we are going to see is we are going to see education, or more accurately, learning, become part of life. Learning will be something that we do on an everyday basis. We'll have breakfast. We'll learn about something. We'll drive the car. The car will teach us something. And learning and life will cease to be so separate. When a person is doing their job, when they're harvesting their beans or whatever, they will be able to create educational resources through that process. And so doing your job and being a teacher will become part and parcel of the same thing. So we want to be sure to make sure that what we use in educational institutions are the sorts of things that we use outside of educational institutions, so that we don't create this wall or this barrier between learning and life. This is my own picture of digital repositories. This is the way I see it in my head. I have a very boring head. And it's still complicated, but really, we can actually draw a very simple path through this. Starting with the production of resources, putting the resources into repositories, aggregating the metadata from those repositories, and then making that available in a common environment, such as a web browser or a personal learning environment. And you see how that can be a very simple flow. And then the other things, like rights and syndication and personal identity, these are sort of things that can apply, but don't necessarily need to apply. Again, think of open access to learning resources. Think about, for example, an academic paper that's been posted in one of these archives and is made available for free to the whole rest of the world. Well, you don't need to log in to get that. You don't need authentication. You don't need digital rights management or anything like that. All you need to do is have the paper on a website and a browser to read the paper. So the rest of this stuff really is optional. It should not be an integral part of the system. It should be something that comes into play only when required. I have a very important reason for saying that. Very simplistically, I can divide the world into two types of content. And of course, I'm overgeneralizing, but free content, not free content. The free content, you get for free. The not free content, you have to pay for it. Now, these are two very different structures and mechanisms, right? Free content, you don't need money, you don't need logins, you don't need access, you don't need any of that sort of stuff. Content you have to pay for, you do need that. You need an economic infrastructure. There's two ways now of looking at the structure of digital resources. And the way that I oppose, you have publishers, people who produce content that you have to pay for, and their view is the entire network should support all of these services. And you sort of think, well, that kind of makes sense. But now, these services aren't free. And each time you have a digital rights management or login or any of these sorts of things, every one of these things adds a cost. Now suppose you're a provider of free content, and you have to provide digital rights management, and you have to provide object identification, and you have to provide authentication or registration. All of these things are costing you money, and it costs you more and more money to make free content available. So, and personally, I'm a conspiracy theorist, it seems to me that this is a deliberate strategy by the people who charge money for content to make it harder to provide free content. So, I say, design the basic architecture of the network as a mechanism for distributing free content. And then, if people want to charge money for content, then they access services that are outside or at the edge of the network in order to facilitate that transaction. I'm going to finish. I'm not sure how much time I have left, and I want to be more sensitive than I was yesterday. Don't say, just keep going. The last time somebody did that, it was 2 hours later before I got out of there. And that wasn't that long ago. But basically, I'm going to look at some of the issues, and we've touched on some of these issues already in repositories. I'm not going to cover all of the issues, because we would be here for the rest of the week, but I want to give you a flavor of the sorts of arguments that are going back and forth in the community. There are many people involved in this community, both on the open access side and the commercial access side. Jeez, he marched up so deliberately, I thought he was coming right up here. Data input or usability. You know, it's hard to create learning resources sometimes, and it's hard to create any sort of content. And so there's been a lot of talk about how to make it easier to create these resources. And this all falls under the heading of usability. In the field of e-learning, there have been some specific learning object creation tools developed. And yesterday we saw a brief mention of a tool called Pachyderm through, what was her name, Christina from the New Media Consortium. I'm sorry, Christina, I've forgotten your last name. Rachel Smith. It was okay, I've forgotten the first name too. Now I'm hoping you're not listening to this. But what we're seeing in the wider internet, remember, like Pachyderm and other things are specific to education, but what we're seeing in the wider internet are content creation tools for various different types of content. Yesterday I mentioned Flickr, and we saw some of the interface in Flickr. I also mentioned Blogger. Remember when I showed you the screen for creating a blog post? And it was just a form. I just filled in the form. And I didn't need to think about the HTML or anything like that. I just typed what I wanted. And if it worked, my blog post goes up. YouTube. If I record a video, and it's very easy. In fact, I'll do it right now. I've never done this. Oh, right, I don't have a card in it. Good stuff, Steve.
Well, I'll keep talking.
But anyhow, if you produce a video... See, this is what happens when you do something unplanned in the middle of your talk. You do things like, forget to put the little card in the camera. But again, all I'm trying to do is just show how easy this is. And now I'm... good job at that. So now I'm recording a video of all of you. Smile. Okay, don't smile. Okay, so now I've recorded my video. I can take my card, upload it into my computer, and then I can access a website like YouTube. And really, it's like I'm going to fill in a little form, you know, the title of the video, where the video was shot, who did the video, and then I'll upload all of that. And what I've done is I've uploaded a digital resource, a multimedia resource, a video, and it's metadata. And then YouTube acts as the repository. And we're seeing this more and more. Rice University, which I mentioned a little bit before, their Connections Project, is, again, one of these form-based systems for the creation of learning resources. I personally think it's a bit more complex than necessary, but if you are authoring formal learning resources, the connection system is a good way to go. Is there a link there? No, it isn't. cnx.rice.edu. And their software is either now open source or will shortly be open source. And so we get, if we take this attitude, that we're not restricted to educational resources, we get the whole range of alternative possibilities. And here in Colombia, for example, Drupal is being used as a learning object repository, or is being set up as a learning object repository. This Drupal as Learning Object Repository, this is an article, a short article by Darcy Norman in Calgary, and he decided, he looked at Drupal, considered whether it could be used as a learning resource repository, and said, yes, and I agree, I've worked extensively with Drupal, it does everything you want a digital repository to do. YouTube, which I just mentioned for video, Flickr. Scott Leslie writes about Hierarchy, which is kind of a strange name. A wiki that is set up in a hierarchical structure so that you can have a digital object repository with multiple authors, a collaborative authoring. And so I haven't looked at NOC, a learning object repository built on top of Hierarchy, but it sounds like a really neat concept. I want to draw your attention to what to me is a fundamental issue in the design of these, especially of these national repository networks and international repository networks. Because remember, this has come up a little bit in different contexts already in the talk, and I've actually introduced it in some different ways, talking about some of the services that are necessary as opposed to the services that are optional, open content as opposed to closed content. In the field of digital repositories, there are two major approaches, or two theories of access to resources, or two search theories, if you will. One is called the Federation, and that's not Star Trek, although you sort of wonder. And the other is metadata harvesting. I've been talking almost entirely yesterday and today about metadata harvesting. And, oh, I put my pictures backwards. Isn't that funny? Okay, the metadata harvesting is the lower picture, and federated searching is the higher picture. Sorry about that. Never do slides after midnight. And as you may imagine, metadata harvesting is the approach that I favor. But there's a very large community in favor of what is called federated searching. And it's hard to draw the distinction, but I'll do it this way. Metadata harvesting is like Google. You think about how Google works. Google has an agent or an engine that goes to websites, goes out there, goes to everybody's website, and gets information and brings it back. And then when you do a search using Google, the only site that you access is Google. So you type in, you know, like Stephen Downs on Google, and Google consults its own records that it's harvested, and then it gives you the results. Now, of course, there's not just Google. There are other search engines. So you don't have only Google. You have Alta Vista, and you have Yahoo, and you have some Microsoft search, which I won't mention. I'm actually testing the translators to see what... I'm kidding. Federated searching works very differently. And honestly, I don't see the attraction. But I've had more arguments with people who want federated searching, especially in university networks. Here's how a federated search works. You access, with your browser, the federated search engine, and you type in your search, Stephen Dems, just like before. But your federated search engine hasn't done any work ahead of time. So you type your thing, and then the federated search checks this website, this website, this website, this website, and you sit there and you wait while it checks all of these websites, and then it brings back the results and it presents them to you. Now, what's the difference? The difference is, in a harvested search, we get the information first and put it all in one place, and then you search that. But in a federated search, you get the information at the exact time you're doing the search. And so the proponents of federated search say, well, it's real time, right? It's real time access. But my response to that is, well, yeah, Google lags by about 24 hours in putting stuff up. I mean, I don't think that that's a real problem. EdgeURSS, which is my service, every hour. So you can have the federated search, which is real time, or you can have a harvest search, which is, you know, once an hour. But more to the point, and I think this is really the thinking behind the federated search, because of the way a federated search is set up, you cannot actually check that many data sources. Because every time you do a search, every data source has to be checked, right? And so, like, Google harvests from a billion websites, give or take 100 million. And imagine a search engine that had to check 100 websites every time somebody typed in a search term. It would be ridiculous. You couldn't do it. So federated search is used in smaller networks. And for example, the EduSource network that we were building in Canada, the federated search was intended to operate over about 10 or 15 resource providers. Now, you remember what I said about eliminating the competition. A federated search means you're getting results only from a certain selected set of privileged content providers. And in order for you, as a producer of open material or independent material, to have your material show up in the search at all, you have to get it into one of these 10 or 15 providers. Now, the proponents of federated search will say, well, this is to ensure quality. But, you know, my own feeling is that it is just as much to ensure privilege. But even more than that, think about what a federated search does to the provider of a digital repository. Imagine you are, you know, the corner school. I don't know if you have corner schools in Bogota, but yeah, you must. And you decide, we want our teachers to make digital resources, and we want them to be free to everybody in the world. And you think, great, let's build a repository. So you get, you know, a computer like that. You hook it up to the internet. You get some sort of repository software. And now you hook into this federated search. Now think about what happens. Every time somebody searches, you get a hit on your repository. Well, this network has a million users. Now you're getting a million hits on your repository every day. Only one person ever uses something. But you're getting all of these search requests. And so it turns out you have to have a very large computer system in order to be part of a federated search network. On the other hand, if you're part of a harvest network, you just set up a little web server, put some metadata, maybe some RSS files, on your website, and send your link to a harvester. And once an hour, the harvester comes to your site, gets your RSS, and then it goes away. So your website is going one hit every hour, and then if people access resources, then you'll get some other hits as they access your resources. The load on your server is much smaller. And so, again, I argue against the federated search because it puts a very large burden on very small providers. And it favors, in my view, unfairly, large content producers, universities, and publishers over smaller producers of learning resources. And that increases, necessarily, the cost of these learning resources. You know, and I think about this. I think about this a lot. I dream about this. I'm a very strange person. And I ask myself, why should we have to search at all? They said, how much time have you spent searching? It's ridiculous. And what we want is a mechanism, a system out there of digital repositories that knows what you want and gives it to you in a list without you having to actually do the search. I call that the self-organizing network. Now, the self-organizing network is a harvesting network at its heart. And the idea is that you are getting, as somebody who's using a learning service of some sort, you are getting a real-time, live, personalized RSS feed. Imagine just at the side of your browser, or at the side of your application, is an RSS feed, and this RSS feed is updating itself all the time. Now, on what basis is it updating itself? Well, that might vary. It might update itself depending on where you're accessing. If you're in your tractor, you'll get one kind of thing. If you're working on a spreadsheet, something else. It might update itself based on what you're writing. If you're typing something, you're typing words. Those words have meaning, and that meaning can be attached to the list that's being updated. So you could be typing an essay, and real time, this RSS feed is suggesting resources. So I'm sitting there, I type the title of my paper, Learning Objects. And in a second or so, the top resources in Learning Objects show up there. My paper at the very top. And then, of course, I just drag and drop the referencing. See, this is all a big scheme for me to get more citations. No, I'm kidding. Another way is your personal learning environment, whatever it is, knows your history. It knows the sorts of things that you've accessed before. It knows what subjects that you're interested in. It knows what links that you like and what links that you don't like. Mine, for example, would notice he never clicks on the Microsoft stuff. And it would slowly sort of stop sending me Microsoft. And my life would be better. Now, this is a hard system to build, but the concepts are very simple. Now, imagine in your head, right now, we've got this dynamic RSS feed that's always giving us resources. It's giving us resources. It's in our tractor. It's in our application. It's all of those applications, all those places where we can learn. And now, these resources all have metadata associated with them. But not just that. Because we don't want, well, that was kind of an odd note. We don't want just any old resources listed there. And people are always talking, right? We want quality resources. We want to know that the resources are good resources. And you talk to the federated search people, they'll be saying that all the time, right? Oh, we have to limit the resources so that there'll be high quality resources from well-established professors, meaning not you. But what you can do is set up what is sometimes called a post-publication review system, or in more common terminology, a recommender system. And what this is the resource is made available on the internet via an RSS feed, and people read the resource. And then people, when they look at the resource, they have one of two reactions. They like it, or they don't like it. And then every shade in between. But, you know, keep it simple. And so they might think, good resource, or bad resource. And so if they had, when they looked at the resource, they had two little buttons, thumbs up, thumbs down, and they click one of those little buttons, now we have an evaluation of this resource. Now, suppose you have 20,000 people reading a resource and giving it a thumbs up and a thumbs down. And 19,000 people who read this resource gave it a thumbs up. That's a pretty good resource. Doesn't matter what the professor said. Doesn't matter who wrote it. It's just 20,000 people read the thing and they liked it. So now we have a system whereby we can have evaluation of learning material without requiring peer review. Remember I mentioned Merlot. What I didn't say about Merlot is after something like 5 years of operation, they had 800 learning resources. It's not enough. But the problem with Merlot was the peer review. Think about how peer review works. It takes a long time. You have to send your content in. The content goes to professors. When the professors get back from their vacation, they begin to read it. 3 months later, they write the peer review thing and send it in. It takes forever. And there's so few people who are able to do this reviewing, right? But it turns out that the reviews by a mass of people are just as good as the reviews by an expert. And this sort of system has been put into practice. There's a website out there called DIGG, DIGG.com, which uses the thumbs up, thumbs down model. But even more interestingly, and that's what this diagram presents, you can have different points of view for reviews. For example, in North America, and possibly here, we have the Church of the Latter-day Saints, or the Mormons, right? And the Mormons have their views about what a good resource is and what a bad resource is. There are resources they don't want to be presented. They have very strict standards about what is acceptable and what is not. And that's fine. Now, they're a community. They're able to define their own standards. So they can have their own Mormon-approved or Mormon-disapproved rating. Or you might have a group of reviewers, say, the community of all the psychologists in the world. And psychologists read psychology papers, because that's what they like to do on Sunday afternoon. And they read their psychology papers, and they put their thumbs up and thumbs down to the psychology review. And so you could get a perspective, this paper was ranked very good by psychologists. Really bad by engineers, but what do they know? I'm kidding. So you see, you have these different points of view. Now, how does this work in practice? Now, you have to picture in your mind all of these reviews as metadata. And so now we've got this review metadata flying around. And we've got the resource metadata flying around. And so we're going to have a lot of this metadata. And we need to conceptualize it and understand it in order to organize it. This is where the theory of resource profiles comes in. And I've written a paper under the same name. Don't start reading it unless you have about like 3 days. There are overall three different types of metadata. The first type of metadata, which I call first-party metadata, is metadata that might be called bibliographic metadata. It's metadata related to the creation or the provenance of the resource. The title, the publisher, the author, the date that it was published. These are non-controversial types of metadata, right? Second party metadata is metadata related to the use of the resource. Remember yesterday I said something is a learning object if it is used to support learning? And you might have asked, well, how do you know? Well, imagine you use a learning object in a mathematics class, and you've dragged and dropped that learning object into the mathematics. Your system should send out some metadata, and the metadata should say, this object was used in a math class. Usage metadata. So we know when and where these resources are used. Or more importantly, we know what context the resource was used in. So we get, as the resource grows over time, we get an increasingly large list of the context in which the resource was used. And then third-party metadata is the evaluative metadata that I was talking about. The rankings, thumbs up, thumbs down. Classifications, this is about psychology, this is about engineering, things like that. And you might think, this is way too complicated. But it isn't. It is, in fact, very simple. That's why I put that wonderful picture of me there. Think, well, but small, because I don't have too big an ego. Think about how people know information about you. Right? Well, there's some pretty basic information. Where you were born, when you were born, what your name is. And this is information that generally you can be trusted to tell me. I ask somebody, what's your name? Mostly people don't lie to me. Sometimes they do. So, when you're born, the very minute you're born, you get some very basic metadata. Date of birth. And then, sometimes a little bit later, you get a name and all of that. And then, as you grow and you do things, you acquire other kinds of metadata. You go to school and you get a student number. And now you have a school. You pass kindergarten and you get a kindergarten graduation diploma. You grow a little bit older and you learn to drive a car and you get a driver's license, and that's more metadata. And then you get, well, because you weren't good, you were bad, you get a criminal record, and that's more metadata. And then you're in an accident, and you go to the hospital, and they take, you know, your blood, and you get a blood type metadata, and leg replacement well, okay, maybe not all that. But, and what I want you to notice about this metadata, right, this happens very naturally, bit by bit, by many different organizations. And the location of this metadata is all over the place. Your police records are at the police station. Your hospital records are at the hospital. Your school records are at the school. Right? Your name and your age and your nationality, those are on your passport. So it's distributed. Now, let's go back, remember, to federated versus harvesting. In federated, remember how this works. I want to know about somebody. I want to know. So I do my search, and the search engine goes to the source of the resource, and I get my metadata. But what metadata do I get? Well, I don't get all of it. All I get is the metadata that was created by the author of the learning resource. No reviews, no evaluations, no classifications except theirs. It's kind of like if you wanted to read a book and the only information you ever got about the book before you decided to buy it was from the publisher. Would you trust that? Is that a good source of information about the book? If you were going to hire somebody to do a job, would you trust only what they said about themselves? Or would you maybe ask for some references, check their criminal record, whatever. If you're looking for a husband, same sort of thing. You know, you check their dental records or whatever. So an aggregation harvesting system allows for these types of metadata records. I talked a bit about authentication and identity yesterday, and again, the same sort of principle applies, where we want authentication to be distributed, the information made available as metadata that can be harvested. And again, this information feeds into our personalized RSS feeds. And then finally, the rights and access, which I also talked about yesterday. And again, the rights can be expressed as metadata, and that too is harvested, and that too becomes part of what informs your personal RSS. And so, very much an overview, and I wish I could have gone on for the rest of the day, but I know that I can't. So I appreciate very much your patience and your indulgence, and I certainly hope that you found some interesting material and things to think about from this presentation. I thank you very much.
Agradecemos al Dr. Stephen Downs por su intervención. Por razones de tiempo, continuaremos con nuestra agenda. Las preguntas e inquietudes, pues, les daremos una dirección de contacto para que nos las hagan llegar y a través de nosotros hacérselas llegar al Dr. Stephen Downs. A continuación, la presentación de Creative Commons, Derechos de Autor para Todos. El Dr. Eric Rincón ofrece disculpas al auditorio por razones de fuerza mayor no puede estar presente, recibamos a la doctora Carolina Botero de Creative Commons, quien nos hará la presentación de derechos de autor para todos.
¿Tiene salida de ese video?
¿Tiene salida? ¿Y si no, yo lo pasamos con una cena?
¿Flash? ¿Tiene salida de video? ¿Tiene salida de video?